Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to UMES 30. I am your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. UMES 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, or UMES, as well as the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. In the summer of 1967, racial tensions that had been simmering for years boiled over in an outburst of violence across the country. While there had been riots in African-American neighborhoods before, most notably in Watts, 1965, the section in Los Angeles, the long hot summer of 1967 saw firebombings, looting, and confrontations with police in more than 150 cities and towns nationwide. The worst of the unrest was in Detroit and Newark, New Jersey, big cities where African Americans set fires and looted businesses, traded gunfire with police, and otherwise vented their frustration at the slow pace of social change 3 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Less well remembered are the many small cities and rural towns that were swept up in the strife. Places like Cambridge, Maryland, not too far from here. Cambridge, 90 miles from the nation's capital, quickly drew the attention of federal authorities at the highest level. It became a place where small town life, small town attitudes, and small town troubles intersected with national politics. The tiny city on Maryland's eastern shore was the site of racial unrest in 1963 and 1967. Today's guest, who's joining us by phone, is one of the nation's foremost authorities on these events in Cambridge during the 1960s. His name is Dr. Peter Levy. Peter is a professor of history at York College in Pennsylvania, where he teaches courses on recent America, the Civil Rights Movement, women in the United States, environmental history, and race and justice. He's written over a dozen books, including The Great Uprising, Race Riots in Urban America During the 1960s, and The Seed Time, The Work and Harvest, New Perspectives on the Black Freedom Struggle in America. I had the privilege to work with Peter 5 years ago at a summer institute at Harvard University. Let me just say that he's not only an excellent scholar, but also an amazing person and a good friend. Peter, thank you so much for joining me for today's episode.
My pleasure, Josh. Great to talk to you.
So let's jump right into it. In 2003, you published a book titled Civil War on Ray Street, The Civil Rights Movement in Cambridge, Maryland. You're not a native of the Eastern Shore, so what was the inspiration for writing this book?
Well, I got to study Cambridge in a pretty roundabout way. I grew up in California, went to a graduate school in New York, and shortly after graduate school, like a lot of graduate students, I started looking for a second project. And I had started teaching a course on the Civil Rights Movement. I was teaching in Rutgers, Newark. And I was interested in exploring kind of the phase of the Civil Rights Movement after 1965, kind of the one you discussed a little bit in your intro. But I also wanted to do a community study. Somewhere in my reading, I had heard about this alleged riot that had taken place in Cambridge in 1967. And before I knew it, I'd gotten a job teaching at York and actually living in Maryland. So I started to explore Cambridge. And then the story just unfolded from there. So I wasn't trying to pick on Cambridge or anything. It just became a place I got to somewhat accidentally.
And how did you actually come across that story of Cambridge?
I think there were, you know, some books that had talked about the riots of the latter 60s, and they always mentioned Newark and they mentioned Detroit. But they often mentioned Cambridge as well because they claimed that this guy named H. Rapp Brown, who then was the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, had incited this riot. And Brown rose from obscurity to become a major figure in the latter part of the 1960s, virtually vilified as this kind of riot-inciting black power radical. So that's how I came across it. And you know, lo and behold, I found that a lot of that story wasn't really all that true.
Right. And in the book, you challenge many traditional narratives, not just about what was happening in Cambridge, but about the civil rights movement in general. For example, the notion that it was purely nonviolent prior to the cause for Black Power in 1966, the notion that this was a male-dominated movement, and then also, like you said, the notion that H.R.A.P. Brown was the cause of the 1967 unrest. So can you speak to each one of those points?
Yeah, sure. Maybe not exactly in that order. So okay. As I started looking at Brown, I realized it was this whole rich and vibrant movement in Cambridge that had existed in the early 60s that had received virtually no coverage. Because I think there was this framing of the movement, as you just put it out, you know, the framing was the movement was nonviolent. It was led by men. The people who advocated self-defense were either prominent later in the 60s or maybe Malcolm X in bigger cities beforehand. And I happened upon this movement that was led in Cambridge by this middle-aged woman named Gloria Richardson. And at the time, Richardson was virtually untalked about in most studies of the civil rights period. And she was an incredible person. She didn't start the movement, but her kids got involved after freedom riders came to the town, and they were getting dispirited. So she became involved, and she came from a political family, and you know, within a year, had built one of the most vibrant movements in the nation.
Peter, quick question before you continue, because I'm sure we may have some listeners who aren't familiar with some of the terms we'll be using in the discussion. So you mentioned,
sure.
You know, you said freedom riders. Can you just tell the audience what the freedom rides were before you continue with Ms. Richardson?
Sure. So the most famous freedom rides was when a dozen blacks and whites had ridden or tried to ride in the South from Washington, D.C. to Mississippi in a desegregated fashion, and had encountered a good deal of resistance in doing so. And this captured national attention. But there were lesser known freedom rides, for example, where blacks and whites would try to ride in buses or attend restaurants or go to other public accommodations first along what we might call the western shore of Maryland and Delaware, and then over to the eastern shore of Maryland in 1962. And so those freedom riders came to Cambridge in early in 1962, and they were resisted. And a chapter of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was established, headed by Richardson, and he was pushing for fundamental equality. But so anyway, Richardson built this vibrant movement, and people largely just ignored it. So you know, her story was interesting both because here she was a middle-aged mother and quite. I'm not sure militant's the way to put it. She just was a very determined person. You know, she was not going to accommodate the system. She held meetings and negotiations with Robert Kennedy, who was then the Attorney General of the U.S., and got an agreement for some change. But the community balked at a lot of the things that Richardson wanted. But then she all along had said, in terms of the question of nonviolence, she favored nonviolent protest, but felt that blacks have the right to defend themselves if they were attacked. And whites in the community frequently used the weapons against them, and she was not going to stop blacks from defending their homes and their person from those whites who shot at them. And she later on befriended Malcolm X, whose argument or kind of views of the world resonated with her. And then in terms of H.R.A.P. Brown, what happened is Richardson remarried a photographer of the civil rights movement and moved with him to New York City in 1965. And the movement in Cambridge died down a little bit. In fact, kind of white reactionaries pretty much took over the city. And then local black activists tried to rejuvenate it in 1967. And they reached out to Richardson, and she helped bring H.R.A.P. Brown to town to give a speech. And the main goal of the speech was to really rejuvenate that movement. And he delivered a pretty fiery address. You know, started off by saying, essentially, if this town don't come around, we should burn it down. And later that night, a fire took place, and the town suffered, you know, serious damages, particularly the black community. And the recently elected governor of the state, this guy named Spiro Agnew, who would later become vice president, rushed to the town and immediately claimed that H.Rap Brown was responsible. The newspapers repeated this. The police chief testified before Senate that Brown was the sole cause of the riots, claimed that Cambridge had good schools, good race relations. But interestingly, there were investigators who showed that this wasn't really the case at all. There was a National Guard commander general, a guy named General Gelston, who had been in town in the early 60s and was there in 67. He had his troops stand down after Brown's speech because there was not a bunch of rioting and burning that took place. Rather, about 2-3 hours later, a small fire took place. And the fire force just refused to put it out. The fire force had been at odds with civil rights activists for years. It had actually been sued because they operated a pool in a segregated manner and refused to desegregate it. And the fire chief even admitted to a reporter of the African American that essentially the blacks had started that fire and, you know, he basically said, let them put it out, but then provided them no means to do so. But that story was buried, you know, that maybe some of the back pages of the newspapers briefly reported on it, but Brown became one of the most vilified people in the nation. And ultimately, in the early 70s, in fact, the Maryland state attorney dropped all riot-related charges against him. And the claim, at least to that local attorney, is that they had never had a case against him in the first place.
And then what ended up happening of Gloria Richardson after all of this?
So it's kind of interesting. She moves to New York, and as a civil rights leader, she pretty much disappears. I mean, she has this 2-3 years where she's pretty well known. She had meetings with the Kennedy, associated with Malcolm X, was one of the co-founders of this group called ACT, which was Malcolm X's first group after he left the Nation of Islam, and then would have been one of the co-founders of the Organization for African American Unity, which he established before he was assassinated. And she tried to go work for various civil rights groups in New York, but for a variety of reasons, that never worked out. But she did, I think, dedicate her life to bettering the lives of ordinary black men and women, and not just black men and women. She worked well into her late 80s in the government of New York, became one of the leaders of the Department of Aging. And I think that, you know, speaks volumes to her commitment to helping working people. Matter of fact, if I were to go back, I think one thing that distinguished the Cambridge movement, besides the fact that Richardson was a middle-aged woman, and besides the fact that she was willing to advocate self-defense, is that while she was part of protests for desegregating public accommodations, she persistently emphasized that the main concerns were better housing, better jobs, and better economic opportunities. And these were issues that largely, this is 63, 64, most of the press really weren't focusing on. They were focusing on things like voting rights, and which blacks in Cambridge always enjoyed. Richardson kind of understood that just to have the vote didn't mean you had power if you were in the minority, which blacks were in Cambridge and in many towns. You may have the vote. They even had one representative, but they were always outnumbered. And whites wouldn't vote for black candidates. Blacks voted for white candidates, and whites, by and large, just kind of feigned interest in getting black jobs, but by and large were maintaining them in this very second-class status.
And I've read that, like, these incidents, particularly in 1967, also helped to put Spiro Agnew on the map as well as a national politician. Is that correct?
Yes, I think Agnew's kind of forgotten. I think we all recognize that there were a lot of politicians who responded to the riots in a pretty much an opportunistic way. Mm-hmm. I think we forget that, in 64, 65, the Republican Party had been a pretty moderate or almost liberal tradition on civil rights, and they had a choice of which way to go. And Agnew just typifies this. He had been known as a moderate Republican politician. He had been a county executive of Baltimore County, and he ran for governor in 1966 as a moderate against a arch segregationist white Democrat. And Agnew won the election really because he won the vast majority of black votes. And then he quickly lurched to the right, became pretty much a spokesperson for the argument that the cause of these revolts or riots were not social and economic conditions, not political disempowerment, but essentially kind of apolitical opportunists who looted for the fun and profit of it. In 1968, there was a commission known as the Kerner Commission, which President Johnson established to investigate the causes of the riots. And the commission concluded that they call them civil disorders had been caused by the social and economic conditions that blacks lived in, or as they put it, the ghetto, and argued that whites had created this ghetto. And Agnew became one of the most famous critics of the Kerner Commission. He had a major convention. He said that the Kerner Commission blamed everyone but those who rioted, or those for the riots. And it was really pretty ludicrous. But it captured Nixon's attention. So he went from being elected governor of a small state in 1966 to being vice president in 1968. So it was one of the most amazing political careers of all time. And if he hadn't been convicted himself of kind of petty corruption charges in 1973, he would have succeeded Nixon as president after Watergate.
So in terms of this book, when you speak on it in the state of Maryland, what's the reception that you get? Is it positive, or people, are they somewhat upset because they don't like the characterization of the city?
So I was at the start at the beginning. So when I started doing my research, I was interested in getting not only kind of the black side, but trying to get the white side of what had taken place. And one of the first persons I interviewed was this guy named Frederick Malkus. And Malkus had been a state assemblyman and then state senator representing Cambridge and the Eastern Shore for nearly a half a century. In fact, if you drive into Cambridge, you drive across the Frederick Malkus Bridge today. And I interviewed him in his office in Annapolis. And Malkus's reaction right away was, why would you want to peel back that scab? Why would you want to look at this? And though there were some whites from Cambridge who talked to me, most of those who did were really on the outside. So there was a famous novelist from Cambridge, a guy named John Barth. His father had been on this fire force, and he talked to me. So the reception of whites, at least initially within Cambridge, was this is a part of our history we'd rather leave kind of uncovered. Most of the black community I talked to was much more receptive. Gloria Richardson was glad to talk to me. A local minister named Inez Grubb was just wonderful walking me around town. And then if I were to fast forward about 50 years, in the summer of 2017, Cambridge decided to hold essentially a commemoration of this alleged H.R.A.P. Brown riot. They called it a reflection on Pine Street. Pine Street was the heart of the black community in Cambridge. And this reflection was organized by a group called the Eastern Shore Network for Change, led by two young black professionals. One's a public defender, a woman named Keisha Petacolis, and another's a social worker, a guy named Dion Banks. They spent years kind of planning for this week-long of events. It wasn't going to be a one-time thing. They want to use it to help really kind of promote social justice in the area. But they think it's really imperative to flip this script or flip the narrative that somehow blacks were responsible for destroying their own community, which they thought is just completely wrong, and one I agree with, and I tried to foster in my book. And they were very receptive. Now, some of the white community has become more receptive. Now, if you drive into Cambridge and cross the Frederick Malkus Bridge, there's this beautiful mural And in the center of the mural is Harriet Tubman, who's also a native of the region. Next to her is Gloria Richardson. And then there are images of just essentially ordinary black working men and women. The community supported us. And they did other things too. You know, they had public speaking, so they're receptive. But yet at the same time, there had to be police guard when this mural was unveiled, because there were still those in the community who thought that what they were trying to do was spark another riot, or who don't want to give blacks a central place, really, in the history of their community. You know, they're upset that the first thing you see when you drive into town is this mural. Mm. And it's not the only mural. It's one of five murals of essentially ordinary people and kind of famous people in Cambridge. So I think the town's still divided, you know, not strictly black-white, but there are divisions.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to UMES 30. Today's guest is Dr. Peter Levy, professor of history from York College in Pennsylvania. He's been talking with us about a book that he wrote. It was published back in 2003, Civil War on Ray Street, the Civil Rights Movement in Cambridge, Maryland. His latest book is entitled The Great Uprising, Race Riots in Urban America During the 1960s. You know, there's that famous Martin Luther King quote that often says that the riot is the voice of the unheard. I may be slightly, you know, getting the quote wrong, but, you know, when we think about that term riot, and some people say, let's not call it a riot, let's call it a social unrest. Very briefly, Peter, can you just tell us a little bit about how you think that we should be defining what actually is a riot, just based on, you know, your past research as well as the new research that you're doing in this current book?
Well, in the current book, I used the title The Great Uprising. So okay. I think it is an uprising. Okay. Riots, I think, at least connotate that they're somehow apolitical, spontaneous acts that don't really have a historical background or a political content. At the same time, I will acknowledge in both the subtitle and when I talk, I use the term riot because that's the term people most commonly use.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think, yeah, but I think uprising is a more accurate description of what's taking place, particularly if you think of it collectively. You know, there's not just one. There's literally hundreds of these throughout the 1960s, as far back as 1963 going into the early 1970s, across the country, in big cities like Detroit and Los Angeles. You know, some of these cities, the places where they take place, the ghettos have their own name, like Harlem and Watts. But small cities like Cambridge and, you know, what to middle-sized cities, one of the other cities I look at intensively in my book is York, Pennsylvania, where I teach, a city of 50,000. So essentially wherever there was a black community of substantial size, there were these uprisings. And they didn't all take the same form. So I know, like in their introductory remarks, I mean, you know, our general view, your introductory remarks, you said, you know, there was arson and looting and shooting. Interestingly, in York, the city I looked at, there was no looting whatsoever and virtually no arson. Essentially, it was a civil war. And in Cambridge, there was a small fire that the white police force and fire force refused to put out. And we forget that often it was, you know, law enforcement figures used these uprisings as an excuse to attack the black community. Just one last example of this is, you know, there was a film that came out on the Detroit uprising and revolt of 1967 last year called Detroit. And the film itself is problematic, but it looks at this incident at the Algiers Hotel in which white policemen just, you know, use the riot as an excuse to essentially execute black people. And this is true. And the trouble with the movie is they try to make it look like it was one rogue cop, when it went much deeper than that.
Do you think we'll get to a point where we will no longer have these major uprisings? I mean, we saw it, you know, just recently with Ferguson and Baltimore. I mean, will we ever reach that point in our nation when we don't see this anymore?
But that's like asking the million-dollar question. Will we get to the point where there'll be total racial and also, you know, economic equality? Mm. I mean, I think the reason to study these events is to refocus our attention on what caused them in the first place. And that what is somewhat scary is the degree to which the conditions that existed that led to the outbursts in the 1960s continued to exist. And in some ways, I think you could argue they're worse because, just geographically, there's more of a black middle class in the suburbs. But if you look at Ferguson, I mean, almost Ferguson's a repeat. Ferguson is blacks from St. Louis had moved out to the, the what's now called the inner suburbs, but they saw Ferguson as the next promised land, and yet Ferguson wasn't the promised land at all. I don't think anyone wants uprisings or revolts. I mean, you would much rather that the political system works the way it's supposed to work, which is rationally deal with problems that we all know exist. But I also don't think we should just see them as strictly racial. I have a colleague, a guy named Kamosi Woodward, who wrote a book on Newark's revolt, and both before and afterwards. But Kamosi's involved in research now that's reminding us that riots or revolts or uprisings take place globally. He's saying it, in world history, there's something called the Warsaw Revolt, or where essentially Jews were rioting because Nazis had kept them in the ghetto, and eventually that was crushed. But somehow we see that as a justified riot. Yet when we look at the revolts of African Americans in the 60s, it's vilified as this kind of dangerous and unconstructive act. He's looking at other ones too. So, there are similar causes to these revolts, over time and in different places.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can listeners find a copy of your latest book?
I guess they can go to Amazon.com. That's or Google Books. They should be able to find both pretty easily.
Okay.
And I'd be glad to send you a link if you want it as well. Josh, my pleasure for talking.
Thank you. This has been awesome.
Great luck with the show, okay?
Hey, thank you so much, Pete. Talk to you later.
Great. Goodbye.
And before we get out of here, we have our segment of the show called Parting Shots. Once again, this is when I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that has piqued my interest. For this week's Parting Shots, I want to focus on a story that I read in The Independent, a London-based newspaper, about citizens in Sweden having microchips inserted into their bodies. These chips are about the size of a grain of rice, and they are inserted between the thumb and the index finger. The chips contain radio frequency identification technology, which is found in credit cards, passports, and key cards used at hotels. Essentially, you no longer need physical credit cards or your smartphone to make transactions because you can scan your finger. The same is true for a passport or a physical ticket to travel. The Swedish company that makes these devices, Biohacks International, say they have already installed more than 4,000 devices in the last 5 years. Critics are concerned with the privacy issues that arise from the use of these chips. Although this trend is most popular in Sweden, it has spread to the United States and some parts of California. So my question to you is, would you allow someone to place a microchip into your body for the sake of convenience at the checkout line or the airport? Just something to think about. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guest today, Dr. Peter Levy. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook. A special shout out to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.